Mark looked more than a little surprised. Emma's cheeks felt as if they must be burning, though when she looked at Julian he seemed unruffled, cool as always. They joined Mark just as Diana swept to the top of the steps. The foreshadow hunter stared down at the hunter. His horse's eyes were blood red, and so was the armor that Gwyn wore. Tough, crimson leather, torn here and there by claw marks and the rips made by weapons. "Because of the cold peace, I cannot bid you welcome," Diana said. "Why are you here, Gwyn Hunter?" Gwyn's ancient gaze glided up and down Diana. There was no malice in it or arrogance, only the fairy appreciation for something beautiful.
"Lovely lady," he said. "I do not think we have met."
Diana looked momentarily nonplussed.
"Diana Rayburn, I am the tutor here."
"Those who teach are honored in the land under the hill," said Gwyn.
Under his arm he carried a massive helmet decorated with a stag's antlers. His hunting horn lay across the pommel of his saddle. Emma boggled. Was Gwyn hitting on Diana? She didn't know fairies did that exactly. She heard Mark make an exasperated noise. "Gwyn," he said, "I give you fair greetings. My heart is gladdened to see you." Emma couldn't help wondering if any of that was true. She knew Mark had complicated feelings for Gwyn. He'd spoken of them sometimes during the nights in her room, head on his hand. She had a clearer picture of the wild hunt now than she'd ever had before, of its delights and horrors, of the strange path Mark had been forced to make for himself between the stars.
"I would that I could say the same," said Gwyn. "I bring dark news from the Unseelie Court. Kieran of your heart."
"He's not of my heart any longer," interrupted Mark. It was a fairy expression. "Of my heart," the closest they might come to saying girlfriend or boyfriend.
"Kieran Hunter has been found guilty of the murder of Irloth," said Gwyn. "He stood trial at the court of the Unseelie, though it was a short affair."
Mark flushed, tensing all over. "And the sentence?"
"Death," said Gwyn. "He will die at the moon's rise, tomorrow night if there's no intervention."
Mark didn't move. Emma wondered if she should do something, move closer to Mark, offer comfort, a gentling hand. But the expression on his face was unreadable. If it was grief, she didn't recognize it. If it was anger, then it was unlike any anger he had shown before.
"That is sad news," Mark said finally.
It was Julian who moved then, stepping to his brother's side. Julian put a hand on Mark's shoulder. Emma felt relief flood through her.
"Is that all?" Gwyn said. "Have you nothing else to say?"
Mark shook his head. He looked fragile, Emma thought worriedly, as if you could see through his skin to the bones underneath.
"Kieran betrayed me," he said. "He is nothing to me now."
Gwyn looked at Mark in disbelief.
"He loved you, and he lost you, and he tried to get you back," he said. "He wanted you to ride with the hunt again. So did I. You were one of our best. Is that so terrible?"
"You saw what happened."
Mark did sound angry now, and Emma herself could not help but remember the twisted quickbeam tree she had leaned against while Irloth whipped Julian, and then her and Kieran and Mark and Gwyn watched. The pain and the blood, the lashes like fire against her skin, though nothing had hurt as much as watching Julian be hurt.
"Irloth whipped my family, my friend, because of Kieran. He whipped Emma and Julian."
"And now you have given up the hunt for them," said Gwyn, his two colored eyes flicking toward Emma. "And so, there is your vengeance, if you wanted it. But where is your compassion?"
"What do you want of my brother?"
Julian demanded, his hand still on Mark's shoulder. "Do you want him to grieve visibly for your amusement? Is that why you came?"
"Mortals," Gwyn said. "You think you know so much, yet you know so little."
His large hand tightened on his helmet.
"I do not want you to grieve for Kieran. I want you to rescue him, Mark Hunter.
Thunder rumbled in the distance, but in front of the Institute there was only silence, profound as a shout. Even Diana seemed struck speechless. In the quiet, Emma could hear the sounds of Livy and the others up in the training room, their voices and laughter. Jules' expression was flat, calculating. His hand on Mark's shoulder was a tight grip now. I want you to rescue him, Mark Hunter. Anger swelled quickly inside Emma. Unlike Jules, she didn't bite it back.
Mark is not of the Wild Hunt any longer, she said hotly. Don't call him Hunter. He isn't one.
He is a shadow hunter, isn't he? Asked Gwyn. Now that he had made his bizarre request, he seemed more relaxed. Once a hunter, always a hunter of some sort.
And now, you wish me to hunt for Kieran?
Mark spoke in a strange, halting tone, as if he were having difficulty getting the words out past his anger.
Why me, Gwyn? Why not you? Why not any of you?
Did you not hear me? Said Gwyn. He is held captive by his father, the Unseelie King himself, in the depths of the court.
And is Mark indestructible, then? You think he can take on the Unseelie Court where the Wild Hunt can't?
It was Diana. She had moved down a step, and her dark hair blew in the desert wind.
Yours is a famous name, Gwyn ap Nudd. You have ridden with the Wild Hunt for hundreds of mortal years. There are many stories about you. Yet never have I heard that the leader of the Wild Hunt had succumbed to madness.
The Wild Hunt is not subject to the rule of the courts, said Gwyn. But we fear them. It would be madness not to. When they came to take Kieran, I and all my hunters were forced to swear a life oath that we would not challenge the trial or its outcome. To attempt to rescue Kieran now would mean death for us.
That's why you've come to me, because I didn't swear. Because even if I did, I can lie.
A lying thief, that's what you want, Mark said.
What I wanted
was one I could trust, said Gwyn. One who was not sworn, one who would dare the court.
We want no trouble with you.
It was Julian, keeping his voice level, with an effort that Emma suspected only she could sense.
But you must see that Mark cannot do what you are asking. It is too dangerous.
We of the Folk of the Air do not fear danger, nor death, said Gwyn.
If you don't fear death, said Julian, then let Kieran meet it.
Gwyn recoiled at the coldness in Julian's voice.
Kieran is not yet 20.
Neither is Mark, said Julian. If you think we're afraid of you, you're right. We'd be fools not to be. I know who you are, Gwyn. I know you once made a man eat his own father's heart. I know you took the hunt from Hearn in a battle over Cadar Idris. I know things that would surprise you. But I am Mark's brother, and I will not let him risk himself in Faerie again.
The Wild Hunt is a brotherhood as well, Gwyn said. If you cannot bring yourself to help Kieran out of love, Mark, do it out of friendship.
Enough, Diana snapped. We respect you here, Gwyn the Hunter, but this discussion is at an end. Mark will not be taken from us.
Gwyn's voice was a bass rumble.
What if he chooses to go?
They all looked at Mark. Even Julian turned, dropping his hand slowly from Mark's shoulder. Emma saw the fear in his eyes. She imagined it was echoed in her own. If Mark still loved Kieran, even a little bit,
I do not choose it, said Mark. I do not choose it, Gwyn.
Gwyn's face tightened.
You have no honor.
Light speared through gaps in the clouds overhead. The storm was moving toward the mountains. The gray illumination cast a film across Mark's eyes, rendering them unreadable.
I thought you were my friend,
he said, and then he turned and stumbled back into the Institute. The door slamming shut behind him. Gwyn began to dismount, but Diana raised her hand, palm out.
You know you cannot enter the Institute, she said.
Gwyn subsided.
For a moment, as he gazed at Diana, his face looked lined and old, though Emma knew he was ageless.
"Kieran is not yet 20," he said again. "Only a boy."
Diana's face softened, but before she could speak, Gwyn's horse reared up. Something flew from Gwyn's hand and landed on the step below Diana's feet. Gwyn leaned forward and his horse exploded into motion, its mane and tail blurring into a single white flame. The flame shot toward the sky and vanished, disappearing into the night's fretwork of clouds. Julian shouldered the door of the Institute open. "Mark? Mark!" The empty foyer swung around him as he turned. Fear for his brother was like pressure on his skin, tightening his veins, slowing his blood. It wasn't a fear he could put a name to. Gwyn was gone. Mark was safe. It had been a request, not a kidnapping. "Jules?" Mark appeared from the closet beneath the staircase, clearly having just hung up his jacket. His blonde hair was tousled, his expression puzzled. "Did he leave?"
"He's gone."
It was Emma who had come in behind Julian. Diana, a step after her, was closing the front door. Mark went straight across the room to Emma without a pause and put his arms around her. The jealousy that flared through Julian took his breath away. He thought he had gotten used to seeing Emma and Mark like this. They weren't a particularly demonstrative couple. They didn't kiss or cuddle in front of other people. Emma wouldn't, Julian thought. She wasn't like that. She was determined, and she was matter of fact, and she would do what needed to be done, but she wasn't cruel. It was Mark who reached for her, usually. For the small, quiet things. The hand on the shoulder, the brushing away of a stray eyelash, a quick embrace. There was an exquisite pain in watching that. More than there would have been in seeing them passionately embracing. After all, when you were dying of thirst, it was the sip of water you dreamed about, not the whole reservoir. But now, the feel of holding Emma was so close, the taste of her still on his mouth, her rose water scent on his clothes. He would play back the scene of their kiss over and over in his head, he knew, until it faded and fragmented and came apart like a photograph folded and unfolded too many times. But it was too close now, like a just-delivered wound. And seeing Emma in Mark's arms was a sharp splash of acid on raw skin, a brutal reminder. He couldn't afford to be sentimental, or to think of her as possibly his, even in an imaginary someday. To consider possibilities was to open yourself up to pain. Reality had to be his focus. Reality. And his responsibilities to his family. Otherwise he would go insane.
"Do you think he'll come back?"
Emma drew back from Mark. Julian thought she cast him an anxious, sideways glance, but he wasn't sure. There was no point wondering. He crushed his curiosity down brutally.
"Gwyn?"
said Mark. "No. I refused him. He won't beg and he won't return."
"Are you sure?"
Julian said. Mark gave him a wry look.
"Do not let Gwyn fool you," he said. "If I do not help him, he will find someone else to do it, or he will do it himself. Kieran will come to no harm."
Emma made a relieved noise. Julian said nothing. He was wondering about Kieran himself. He remembered how the fairy boy had gotten Emma whipped bloody and broken Mark's heart. He remembered also how Kieran had helped him defeat Malcolm. Without him, they would have had no chance. And he remembered what Kieran had said to him before the battle with Malcolm. "You are not gentle. You have a ruthless heart." If he could have saved Kieran by risking his own safety, he would have. But he would not risk his brother. If that made him ruthless, so be it. If Mark was right, Kieran would be fine anyway.
"Diana," said Emma.
Their tutor was leaning against the closed front door, looking down at her palm.
"What did Gwyn throw at you?"
Diana held out her hand. Glimmering on her brown skin was a small golden acorn. Mark looked
surprised. "That is a fair gift," he said. "Should you crack open that acorn, Gwyn would be summoned to aid you." "Why would he give Diana something like that?" asked Emma.
The ghost of a smile touched Mark's mouth as he began to mount the stairs. "He admired her," he said. "It is rare I have seen Gwyn admire a woman before. I had thought perhaps his heart was closed to that sort of thing."
"Gwyn has a crush on Diana?"
Emma inquired, her dark eyes brightening.
"I mean, not that you're not very attractive, Diana. It just seems sudden."
"Fairies are like that," said Julian. He almost felt for Diana. He had never seen her look so rattled. She was worrying at her lower lip with her teeth, and Julian remembered that Diana really wasn't very old, only 28 or so, not that much older than Jace and Clary.
"It doesn't mean anything," she said. "And besides, we have more important things to think about."
She dropped the acorn into Mark's hand just as the front door flew open and the Centaurians poured in. They looked wind-tossed and soaking wet, every one of them drenched. Diana, seeming relieved to no longer be talking about her love life, went off to find blankets and towels. Drying runes notoriously worked well to dry your skin, but didn't do much for your clothes.
"Did you find anything?" Emma asked.
"I think we've located the likely spot where the body sank," said Manuel. "But the sea was too rough for us to dive for it. We'll have to try again tomorrow."
"Manuel," Zara said warningly, as if he'd revealed the secret passcode that would open the gates to hell under their feet.
Manuel and Rayan rolled their eyes.
"It's not like they don't know what we're looking for, Zara."
"The Scholomancer's methods are secret."
Zara thrust her damp jacket into Diego's arms and turned back to Emma and Julian.
"Right," she said. "What's for dinner?"
"I can't tell any of them apart," said Kit. "It's the uniforms. It makes them all look the same to me, like ants."
"Ants don't all look the same," said Ty.
They were sitting at the edge of the second-floor gallery, overlooking the main institute entryway below. Wet Centaurians scurried to and fro. Kit saw Julian and Emma, along with Diana, trying to make conversation with the ones who hadn't wandered off to the dining room and the fireplace there to get warm.
"Who is everyone again?" said Kit. "And where are they from?"
"Dane and Samantha Larkspear," said Livy, indicating two dark-haired Centaurians.
"Atlanta."
"Twins," said Ty.
"How dare they," said Livy with a grin.
Kit had been worried she wouldn't be thrilled with Ty's plan to absorb Kit into his detecting plans, but she'd just given a wry smile when they'd come over to her in the training room and said,
"Welcome to the club."
Livy pointed.
"Manuel Casales Villalobos, from Madrid. Rayan Maduabachi, Lagos Institute. Divya Joshi, Mumbai Institute. Not everyone's connected with an institute, though. Diego's not. Zara isn't, or her friend Jessica, who's French, I think. And there's John Cartwright and Jen Whitelaw and Thomas Aldertree, all Academy graduates." She tilted her head. "And not one of them has the sense to come in out of the rain."
"Tell me again why you think they're all up to something," Kit said.
"All right," said Ty. Kit had noticed already that Ty responded directly to what you said to him, and much less so to tone or intonation. Not that he couldn't use a refresher on why they were halfway up a building staring at a bunch of jerks.
"I was sitting in front of your room this morning when I saw Zara go into Diana's office. When I followed her, I saw she was going through papers there."
"She could have had a reason," said Kit.
"To be sneaking through Diana's papers? What reason?" said Livy, so firmly that Kit had to admit that if it looked scurrilous, it probably was scurrilous.
"I texted Simon Lewis about Cartwright, Whitelaw, and Aldertree," said Livy, resting her chin on the lower crossbar of the railing. "He says Jen and Thomas are solid, and Cartwright is kind of a lunk, but basically harmless."
"They might not all be involved," said Ty. "We have to figure out which of them are and what they want."
"What's a lunk?" said Kit.
"Sort of a combination of hunk and lump, I think, as in large but not that smart."
Livy grinned her quick grin as a shadow rose up over them. Christina, her hands on her hips, her eyebrows quirked.
"What are you three doing?" she asked.
Kit had a healthy respect for Cristina Rosales. Sweet as she looked, he'd seen her throw a balisong 50 feet and hit her target exactly.
Nothing,
said Kit.
Making rude comments about the Centaurians, said Livy.
For a moment, Kit thought Cristina was going to scold them. Instead, she sat down next to Livy, her mouth curling up into a smile.
Count me in, she said.
Ty was resting his forearm on the crossbar. He flicked his storm cloud gray eyes in Kit's direction.
Tomorrow, he said quietly, we follow them to see where they go.
Kit was surprised to find he was looking forward to it.
It was an uncomfortable evening. The Centaurians, even after drying off, were exhausted and reluctant to talk about what they'd done that day. Instead, they descended on the dining room and the food laid out there, like ravenous wolves. Kit, Ty, and Livy were nowhere to be seen. Emma didn't blame them. Meals with the Centaurians were an increasingly uncomfortable affair. Though Divya, Rayon, and John Cartwright tried their best to hold up a friendly conversation about where everyone planned to spend their travel year, Zara soon interrupted them with a long description of what she'd been doing in Hungary before she'd arrived at the Institute. Bunch of shadow hunters complaining that their steelies and seraph blades stopped working during a fight with some fairies, she said, rolling her eyes. We told them it was just an illusion. Fairies fight dirty, and they should be teaching that at the academy.
Fairies don't fight dirty, actually, said Mark. They fight remarkably cleanly. They have a strict code of honor.
Honor?
Samantha and Dane laughed at the same time.
I doubt you know what that means, half.
They paused. It had been Dane who was speaking, but it was Samantha who flushed. The word, unspoken, hung in the air. Half-breed. Mark shoved his chair back and walked out of the room.
Sorry, Zara said into the silence that followed his departure. But he shouldn't be sensitive. He's going to hear a lot worse if he goes to Alicante, especially at a council meeting.
Emma stared at her incredulously.
That doesn't make it all right, she said. Just because he's going to hear something ugly from the bigots on the council doesn't mean he should hear it first at home.
Or ever at home, said Cristina, whose cheeks had turned dark red.
Stop trying to make us feel guilty, Samantha snapped. We're the ones who've been out all day trying to clean up the mess you made. Trusting Malcolm Fade, like you could trust a damn worlder. Didn't you people learn anything from the Dark War? The fairies stabbed us in the back. That's what downworlders do, and Mark and Helen will do it, to you too, if you're not careful.
You don't know anything about my brother or my sister, said Julian. Please refrain from saying their names. Diego had been sitting beside Zara in stony silence. He spoke finally, his lips barely moving. Such blind hatred does no credit to the office or the uniform of Centaurians, he said. Zara lifted her glass, her fingers curled tightly around the slender stem.
I don't hate downworlders, she said, and there was cool conviction in her voice.
It was more chilling somehow than passion would have been.
The Accords haven't worked. The Cold Peace doesn't work. Downworlders don't follow our rules, or any rules that aren't in their interest to follow. They break the Cold Peace when they feel like it. We are warriors. Demons should fear us, and downworlders should fear us. Once we were great. We were feared, and we ruled. We're a shadow now of what we were then. All I'm saying is that when the systems aren't working, when they've brought us down to a level we're at now, then we need a new system. A better one.
Zara smiled, tucked a stray bit of hair back into her immaculate bun, and took a sip of water. They finished dinner in silence.
She lies. She just sits there and lies like her opinions are facts, said Emma furiously.
After dinner, she'd retreated with Cristina to the other girl's room. They were both sitting on the bed, Cristina worrying her dark hair between her fingers.
I think they are, to her, and those like her, said Cristina. But we should not waste time on Zara. You said on the way upstairs that you had something to tell me?
As concisely as she could, Emma caught Christina up on the visit from Gwyn. As Emma talked, Christina's face grew more and more pinched with worry.
Is Mark all right?
I think so. He can be really hard to read sometimes.
He's one of those people with a lot going on in his head, said Christina.
Has he ever asked about you and Julian?
Emma shook her head violently. I don't think it would ever cross his mind that we had anything but parabatai feelings for each other. Jules and I have known each other for so long.
She rubbed at her temples.
Mark assumes Julian feels the same way about me that he does. Brotherly.
It's strange, the things that blind us, said Christina. She drew her knees up, her hands looped around them.
Have you tried to reach Jaime? Emma asked.
Christina leaned her cheek on top of her knees.
I sent a fire message, but I haven't heard anything.
He was your best friend, Emma said. He'll respond. She twisted a piece of Christina's woven blanket between her fingers.
You know what I miss most about Jules? Just being parabatai. Being Emma and Julian. I miss my best friend. I miss the person I told everything to all the time. The person who knew everything about me. The good things and the bad things.
She could see Julian in her mind's eye as she spoke, the way he had looked during the Dark War. All thin shoulders and determined eyes. The sound of a knock on the door echoed through the room. Emma glanced at Christina. Was she expecting someone? But the other girl looked as surprised as she did.
Pasa,
Christina called. It was Julian. Emma looked at him in surprise, the younger Julian of her memory blurring back into the Julian standing in front of her, a nearly grown-up Julian, tall and muscular, his curls unruly, a hint of stubble prickling along his jawline.
Do you know where Mark is? He asked without preamble.
Isn't he in his room? Emma said. He left during dinner, so I thought.
Julian shook his head.
He's not there.
Could he be in your room?
It cost him visible effort to ask, Emma thought. She saw Christina bite her lip and prayed Julian wouldn't notice. He could never find out how much Christina knew.
No, Emma said. I locked my door. She shrugged. I don't completely trust the Centaurians.
Julian ran a hand distractedly through his hair.
Look, I'm worried about Mark. Come with me and I'll show you what I mean.
Christina and Emma followed Julian to Mark's room. The door was propped wide open. Julian went in first and then Emma and Christina, both of them glancing around carefully, as if Mark might be found hiding in a closet somewhere. Mark's room had changed a great deal since he'd first come back from Faerie. Then it had been dusty, a clearly unused space kept empty for the sake of memory. All his things had been cleared out and put into storage, and the curtains, filmed with dust, had been always drawn. It was very different now. Mark had folded his clothes in neat stacks at the foot of his bed. He'd told Emma once that he didn't see the point of a wardrobe or a dresser, since all they did was hide your clothes from you. The windowsills were covered with small items from nature, flowers in various stages of drying, leaves and cactus needles, shells from the beach. The bed was made neatly. Clearly he hadn't slept in it once. Julian looked away from the too orderly bed.
His boots are gone, he said. He only had one pair. They were supposed to ship more from Idris, but they haven't yet. His jacket, too, Emma said.
It had been his only heavy one, denim-lined with shearling.
His bag? He had a duffel bag, didn't he?
Christina gave a gasp. Emma and Julian both swung to look at her, and she reached up for a piece of paper that had just appeared, floating at shoulder height. Glowing runes sealed it shut. They faded as she caught the fire message out of the air.
"Addressed to me," she said, tearing it open, "from Mark." Her eyes scanned the page, her cheeks paled, and she handed over the paper without a word. Julian took the message, and Emma read over his shoulder as he studied it. "My dear Christina, I know you will show this to the right people at the right time. I can always trust you to do what is necessary when it needs to be done. By now you know what has happened with Kieran's arrest. Though things ended badly between us, He was my protector for many fairy years. I owe him, and I cannot leave him to die in the grim court of his father. I take the moon's road for fairy tonight. Tell my brothers and sisters I will return to them as soon as I can. Tell Emma I will be back. I returned to them from the land under the hill once before. I will do it again. Mark Blackthorne. Julian crumpled the paper viciously between unsteady fingers. I'm going after him. Emma started to reach for his arm before remembering and dropped her hand to her side.
I'm coming with you.
No, Julian said. Do you understand what Mark's trying to do? He can't invade the Unseelie Court by himself. The King of Shadows will have him killed before he can blink.
Of course I understand, said Emma.
That's why we need to get to Mark before he makes it to an entrance into Faerie. Once he enters the Fair Folk's lands, it'll be practically impossible to intercept him.
There's also the issue of time, said Christina. Once he crosses the border, time will be different for him. He could come back in 3 days or 3 weeks.
Or 3 years, said Emma grimly. Which is why I should go after him now, said Julian, before he makes it into Faerie and time starts being our enemy.
I can help with that, Christina said.
Fairies had been Christina's special field of study when she was growing up. She'd once confessed to Emma that this had been partly because of Mark and what she'd learned about him as a child. He'd fascinated her, a shadow hunter boy taken by fairies during the Dark War. Christina touched the pendant at her throat, the golden pendant that bore an image of Raziel.
This is a fairy-blessed charm. My family has...
She hesitated.
Many of them. Years ago, they were close with the fair folk. We still have many tokens of their regard. We speak of it little, though, as the Clave's attitude toward those who befriend fair folk is...
She glanced around Mark's room.
As you know it to be.
What does the charm do? Said Emma.
It keeps time from passing too quickly for mortals in the fair folk's realm.
Christina held the pendant between her fingers, gazing at Jules with quiet inquiry, as if to say she had many more surprises up her neat sleeves, if he cared to hear them.
It's only one pendant, said Julian. How can it protect us all? If I wear it into the realm, the protection will extend to you and Emma and Mark, too, as long as you do not go too far away from me.
Julian leaned against the wall and sighed.
And I suppose you're not going to consider just giving it to me, so I can wear it into Faerie, by myself?
Absolutely not. Christina said primly. It's a family heirloom.
Emma could have kissed Christina.
She settled for winking at her. The corner of Christina's lip curled up slightly.
Then the three of us will go, Emma said, and Julian seemed to realize there would be no point in disagreement.
He nodded at her, and there was a little of the old Parabatai look in his eye, the look that said that he expected the two of them to enter into danger together.
The pendant will also allow us to take the moon's road, said Christina. Usually only those with fairy blood can access it.
She squared her shoulders.
Mark will not imagine that we could follow him. That is why he sent the note.
The moon's road, Julian said. What is that exactly?
At that, Christina did smile. It was an odd smile, not quite a look of happiness. And Emma expected that she was too worried for that. But there was a little bit of wonder in it. The look of someone who was getting to experience something they never thought they'd get a chance to.
I'll show you, she said.
They gathered their things swiftly. The house was dark, unusually alive with the untidy breathing of multiple sleepers.
As Julian moved down the hallway, sliding the straps of his pack over his shoulders, he saw Ty asleep in front of Kit's room, half sitting up, his chin in his hand. A book was open beside him on the floor. Julian paused at the door to the attic. He hesitated. He could leave a note, walk away. That would be the easier thing to do. There wasn't much time. They had to get Mark before he got into Faerie. It wouldn't be cowardly, just practical, just... He shoved the door open and pounded up the stairs. Arthur was where he had left him, at his desk. Moonlight streamed in, angular, through the skylight. Arthur dropped his pen and turned to look at Julian.
Gray hair framed his tired blackthorn eyes. It was like looking at a blurred picture of Julian's father, something that had been flawed in the development process, pulling the angles of his face out of familiar alignment.
"I have to leave for a few days," Julian said. "If you need anything, talk to Diana. Not to anyone else. Just Diana."
Arthur's eyes seemed glazed.
Where are you going, Julian?
Julian considered lying. He was good at lying, and it came easily to him, but for some reason he didn't want to.
Mark went back, he said. I'm going to get him, hopefully before he crosses over into Ferry.
A shudder went through Arthur's body.
You're going after your brother in Ferry? He said hoarsely,
and Julian remembered the shreds of what he knew of his uncle's story, that he had been trapped with Julian's father, Andrew, in Ferry for years, that Andrew had fallen in love with a gentry woman and fathered Helen and Mark on her, but Arthur had been separated from him, locked away, tortured with enchantments.
Yes, Julian shifted his back to one shoulder.
Arthur reached his hand out as if he meant to take Julian's, and Julian flinched back, startled.
His uncle never touched him. Arthur dropped his hand.
In the Republic of Rome, he said, there was always a servant assigned to every general who won a war. When the general rode through the streets, accepting the thanks of a grateful people, the servant's task was to whisper in his ear, Respice poste, hominum te esse memento, memento mori.
Look behind you, Julian translated. Remember that you are a man. Remember that you will die.
A faint shiver went up his spine.
You're young, but you're not immortal, Arthur said. If you find yourself in Ferry, and I pray that you do not, for it is hell there if there ever was a hell, if you find yourself there. Listen to nothing the fairies tell you. Listen to none of their promises. Swear to me, Julian.
Julian exhaled. He thought of that long-ago general, being exhorted not to let glory go to his head, to remember that everything passed, everything went, happiness went, and so did loss and pain. Everything but love.
I swear, he said.
We have to wait for a moment, said Christina, where the moon on the water seems solid. You can see it if you look, like the green flash.
She smiled at Emma, who stood between Jules and Christina, the three of them in a line at the edge of the ocean. There was little wind, and the ocean stretched out before them, thick and black, edged with white where the water met the sand. Surges of sea foam, where the waves had broken and spent themselves on the tide line, pushed seaweed and bits of shells farther up the beach. The sky had cleared from the earlier storm. The moon was high, casting a perfect, unbroken line of light across the water, reaching toward the horizon. The waves made a soft noise like whispers as they spilled around Emma's feet, the surf lapping at her waterproofed boots. Jules had his gaze on his watch. It had been his father's, a large old-fashioned mechanical watch, gleaming on his wrist. Emma saw with a slight lurch that the sea-glass bracelet she'd fashioned for him was still on his wrist beside it, shining in the moonlight.
Almost midnight, he said. I wonder how much of a head start Mark has.
It depends on how long he had to wait for the right moment to step on the path, said Christina. Such moments come and go. Midnight is only one of them.
So how are we planning on capturing him? Emma said. Just your basic chase and tackle, or are we going to try to distract him with the power of dance and then lasso his ankles?
Joke's not helping, said Julian, staring at the water.
Jokes always help, said Emma, especially when we're not doing anything else but waiting for the water to solidify.
Christina squeaked.
Go, now!
Emma went first, leaping over a small wave, crashing at her feet. Half her brain was telling her that she was throwing herself into water, that she'd splash down into it. The impact when her boots struck a hard surface was jarring. She took a few running steps and spun around to face the beach. She was standing on a gleaming path, that looked as if it were made of hard rock crystal, cut thin as glass. The moonlight on the water had become solid. Julian was already behind her, balanced on the shimmering line, and Christina was leaping onto the path behind him. She heard Christina gasp as she landed. As shadow hunters, they had all seen wonders, but there was something distinctly fairy about this kind of magic. It seemed to take place in the interstices of the normal world, between light and shadow, between one minute and another. As Nephilim, they existed in their own space. This was between. "Let's move," Julian said, and Emma began to walk. The path was wide. It seemed to flex and curl under her feet with the motion and ripple of the tide. It was like walking on a bridge held suspended over a chasm. Except that when she looked down, she didn't see empty space. She saw what she feared much more. The deep darkness of the ocean, where her parents' dead bodies had floated before they washed up on the shore. For years she had imagined them struggling, dying underwater, miles of sea all around, totally alone. She knew more now about how they'd died, knew they'd been dead when Malcolm Fade had consigned their bodies to the sea. But you couldn't speak to fear, couldn't tell it the truth. Fear lived in your bones. This far out, Emma would have expected the water to be so deep it was opaque. But the moonlight made it glow as if from within. She could gaze down into it as if into an aquarium. She saw the fronds of seaweed moving and dancing with the push and pull of the tides. The flutter of schools of fish. Darker shadows, too. Bigger ones. Flickers of movement, heavy and enormous, a whale, perhaps, or something bigger and worse. Water demons could grow to the size of football fields. She imagined the path breaking up suddenly, giving way, and all of them plunging into the darkness, the enormity all around them, cold and deathly, and filled with blind-eyed, shark-toothed monsters. And the angel knew what else, rising up out of the deep. "Don't look down," it was Julian, approaching on the path. Christina was a little behind him, looking around in wonder. "Look straight ahead at the horizon. Walk toward that." She raised her chin. She could feel Jules next to her, feel the warmth coming off his skin, raising the hair along her arms.
"I'm fine."
"You're not," he said flatly. "I know how you feel about the ocean." They were far out from shore now. It was a shining line in the distance, the highway, a ribbon of moving lights, the houses and restaurants along the coastline glimmering.
"Well, as it turns out, my parents didn't die in the ocean."
She took a shuddering breath.
"They didn't drown." "Knowing that doesn't wipe out years of bad dreams,"
Julian glanced toward her. The wind blew soft tendrils of his hair against his cheekbones. She remembered what it felt like to have her hands in that hair, how holding him had anchored her, not just to the world, but to herself.
"I hate feeling like this," she said,
and for a moment even she wasn't sure what she was talking about.
"I hate being afraid. It makes me feel weak."
"Emma, everyone's afraid of something." Julian moved closer. She felt his shoulder bump hers. "We fear things because we value them. We fear losing people because we love them. We fear dying because we value being alive. Don't wish you didn't fear anything. All that would mean is that you didn't feel anything."
"Jules."
She started to turn toward him in surprise at the intensity in his voice, but paused when she heard Christina's footsteps quicken, and then her voice raised in recognition, calling,
"Mark!"
Chapter 8. Near the River. Emma saw Mark immediately, a shadow out on the gleaming path before them, the moonlight sparkling off his pale hair. He didn't seem to have noticed them yet. Emma began to run, Christina and Jules at her heels. Though the path surged and dipped under her, she was used to running on the beach where the soft sand gave way under her feet. She could see Mark clearly now. He'd stopped walking and turned to face them, looking astonished. His gear was gone. He was wearing clothes similar to the ones he'd come to the Institute in, though clean and undamaged, linen and soft, tanned hide, high-laced boots, and a duffel bag slung over his back. Emma could see the stars reflected in his wide eyes as she drew closer to him. He dropped the duffel bag at his feet, looking accusingly at his three pursuers. "What are you doing here?"
"Seriously?" Julian kicked Mark's duffel bag aside, grabbing hold of his brother's shoulders. "What are you doing here?"
Julian was taller than Mark, a fact that always struck Emma as odd. Mark had been taller for so many years, taller and older, but he was neither now. He looked like a slim, pale blade in the darkness, against Julian's more solid strength and height. He looked as if he might at any moment turn into moonlight on the waves and vanish. He turned his gaze to Christina.
"You got my fire message?"
She nodded, tendrils of her dark hair caught in a jeweled clip at the back of her head, curling around her face.
"We all read it."
Mark closed his eyes.
"I had not thought you could follow me on the moon's road."
"But we did." Julian tightened his hands on Mark's shoulders. "You're not going anywhere in Faerie, much less alone."
"It's for Kieran," Mark said simply.
"Kieran betrayed you," said Julian.
"They will kill him, Jules," said Mark. "Because of me. Kieran killed Irloth because of me."
He opened his eyes to gaze into his brother's face.
"I should not have tried to leave without telling you. That was unfair of me. I know you would try to stop me, and I knew I had little time. I will never forgive Kieran for what happened to you and Emma, but I will not leave him to death and torture either."
"Mark, the fair folk aren't fond of you," said Julian. "They were forced to give you back, and they hate giving back anything they take. If you go into Faerie, they'll keep you there if they can, and it won't be easy. They will hurt you. I won't let that happen."
"Then you will be my jailer, brother?"
Mark held out his hands, palms up.
"You will bind my wrists in cold iron, my ankles with thorns?"
Julian flinched. It was too dark to see Mark's blackthorn features, his blue-green eye, and in the dimness the brothers seemed only a shadow hunter and a fairy, eternally at odds.
"Emma,"
Julian said, removing his hands from Mark's shoulders. There was a desperate bitterness in his voice. "Mark loves you. You convince him." Emma felt Julian's bitterness like thorns under her skin and heard Mark's anguished words again.
"Will you be my jailer?"
"We aren't going to stop you from going. We're going to go with you." Even in the moonlight, she could see Mark's face lose color.
"No! You're obviously Nephilim. You're in gear. Your runes aren't hidden. Shadowhunters are not well loved in the land under the hill."
"Apparently only Kieran is," said Julian. "He's lucky to have your loyalty, Mark, since we don't." At that, Mark flushed and turned toward his brother, his eyes glittering angrily.
"All right, stop, stop,"
Emma said, taking a step toward them. The shimmering water bent and flexed beneath her feet.
"Both of you."
"Who walks the path of moonlight?"
A figure approached, its voice a deep boom above the waves. Julian's hand went to the hilt of the dagger at his waist. Emma's seraph blade was out. Christina had her bali song in hand. Mark's fingers had reached for the place where the elf bolt Kieran had given him had once rested in the hollow of his throat. It was gone now. His face tightened before relaxing into recognition.
"It's a puka," he said under his breath. "Mostly they're harmless."
The figure on the path before them had drawn closer. It was a tall fairy, dressed in ragged trousers held up by a belt of rope. Thin strands of gold were woven into his long dark hair and gleamed against his dark skin. His feet were bare. He spoke, and his voice sounded like the tide at sunset.
"Seek you to enter through the gate of Lear?"
"Yes,"
said Mark. Metallic gold eyes without irises or pupils passed over Mark, Christina, Julian, and Emma.
"Only one of you is Fae," the Puka said. "The others are human."
"No,
Nephilim.
Thin lips curled into a smile.
That is a surprise. How many of you wish to pass through the gate to the Shadowlands?
All of us, said Emma. The four.
If the king or queen finds you, they will kill you, said the Pooka. The fair folk are not friendly to the angel-blooded, not since the cold peace.
I am half-fairy, said Mark. My mother was the Lady Nerissa of the Seelie Court. The Pooka raised his eyebrows.
Her death grieved us all.
And these are my brothers and sisters, Mark continued, pressing his advantage. They would accompany me. I will protect them. The Pooka shrugged.
It is not my concern what befalls you in the lands, he said. Only that first you must pay the toll. No payments, said Julian, his hand tightening on his dagger hilt. No tolls. The Pooka smiled. Come here and speak to me for a moment in private, and then decide if you would pay my price. I will not force you.
Julian's expression darkened, but he stepped forward. Emma strained to hear what he was saying to the Pooka, but the sound of wind and waves slid between them. Behind them the air swirled and clouded. Emma thought she could see a shape in it, arched like the shape of a door. Julian stood motionless as the Pooka spoke, but Emma saw a muscle twitch in his cheek. A moment later, he unsnapped his father's watch from around his wrist and dropped it into the Pooka's hand.
One payment, said the Pooka loudly as Julian turned away. Who would come next?
I will, said Christina, and moved carefully across the path toward the Pooka. Julian rejoined Mark and Emma.
Did he threaten you? Emma whispered. Jules, if he threatened you?
He didn't, Julian said. I wouldn't let Christina near him if he had.
Emma turned to watch as Christina reached up and pulled the jeweled clip from her hair. It cascaded down over her back and shoulders, blacker than the night sea. She handed the clip over and began to walk back toward them, looking dazed.
Mark Blackthorne will go last, said the Pooka. Let the golden-haired girl come to me next.
Emma could feel the others watching her as she went toward the Pooka. Julian more intensely than the rest. She thought of the painting he'd done of her, where she'd risen above the ocean with a body made of stars. She wondered what he'd done with those paintings, if he'd thrown them all out. Were they gone? Burned? Her heart ached at the thought. Such lovely work of Jules, every brushstroke a whisper, a promise. She reached the ferry, who stood slyly smiling, as his kind did when they were amused. All around them the sea stretched, black and silver. The Pooka bent his head to speak to her. The wind rushed up around them. She stood with him inside a circle of cloud. She could no longer see the others.
If you're going to threaten me, she said before he could speak, understand that I will hunt you down for it, if not now, then later. And I will make you die for a long time.
The Pooka laughed. His teeth were also gold, tipped in silver.
Emma Carstairs, he said. I see you know little about Pookas. We are seducers, not bullies. When I tell you what I tell you, you will wish to go to Ferry. You will wish to give me what I ask for.
And what do you ask for?
That steely, he said, pointing to the one in her belt. Everything in Emma rebelled. The steely had been given to her by Jace years ago in Idris after the Dark War. It was a symbol of everything that had marked her life after the war. Clary had given her words, and she had treasured them. Jace had given her a steely, and with it given a grief-stricken and frightened girl a purpose. When she touched the steely, it whispered that purpose to her. The future is yours now. Make it what you will.
What use could a fairy have for a steely? She asked. You don't draw runes, and they only work for shadow hunters.
No use for a steely, he said.
but for the precious demon bone of the handle, quite a lot. She shook her head.
Choose something else.
The puka leaned in. He smelled of salt and seaweed baking in the sun. Listen, he said. If you enter, fairy, you will again see the face of someone you loved, who is dead.
What?
Shock stabbed through Emma.
You're lying.
You know I cannot lie. Emma's mouth had gone dry. You must not tell the others what I told you, or it will not happen, said the puka. Nor can I tell you what it means. I am only a messenger. But the message is true. If you wish to look again upon one you have loved and lost, if you wish to hear their voice, you must pass through the gate of Lear.
Emma drew the stele from her belt. A pang went through her as she handed it over. She turned away blindly from the puka, his words ringing in her ears. She was barely aware of Mark brushing past her, the last to speak to the water fairy. Her heart was pounding too hard.
One you have loved and lost. But there were many, so many, lost in the dark war.
Her parents, but she did not even think of them. She would lose her ability to think, to go on. The Blackthorn's father, Andrew, her old tutor, Katerina, maybe. The sound of wind and waves died down. Mark stood before the puka in silence, his face pale. All three of the others looked stricken, and Emma burned to know what the fairy had told them. What could compel Jules or Mark or Christina to cooperate? The puka thrust out his hand.
Lear's gate opens, he said. Take it now, or flee back toward the shore. The moon's road begins to dissolve already.
There was a sound like shattering ice melting under spring sunlight. Emma looked down. The shining path below was riven with black where the water was springing up through the cracks. Julian grabbed her hand.
We have to go, he said.
Behind Mark, who stood ahead of them on the path, an archway of water had formed. It gleamed bright silver. The inside of it churned with water in motion. With a laugh, the puka leapt from the path with an elegant dive and slipped between the waves. Emma realized she had no idea what Mark had given him. Not that it seemed to matter now. The path between them was shattering rapidly. Now it was in pieces, like ice floes in the Arctic. Christina was on Emma's other side. The three of them pushed forward, leaping from one solid piece of path to another. Mark was gesturing toward them, shouting, the archway behind him solidifying. Emma could see green grass through it, moonlight and trees. She pushed Christina forward, Mark caught her, and the two of them vanished through the gate. She moved to take a step forward, but the path gave way under her feet. For what seemed like much more than seconds, she tumbled toward the black water. Then Julian had caught her, his arms around her. They fell together through the arch. The shadows had lengthened in the attic. Arthur sat motionless, gazing out the window with its torn paper at the moonlight over the sea. He could guess where Julian and the others were now. He knew the moon's road as he knew the other roads of Faerie. He had been driven down them by hooting packs of pixies and goblins, riding ahead of their masters, the unearthly beautiful princes and princesses of the gentry. Once, in a winter forest, he had fallen, and his body had shattered the ice of a pond. He recalled watching his blood spray across the pond's silvered surface.
How pretty, a fairy lady had mused, as Arthur's blood melted into the ice.
He thought of his mind that way sometimes, a shattered surface reflecting back a broken and imperfect picture. He knew his madness was not like human madness. It came and went, sometimes leaving him barely touched, so he hoped it was gone forever. Then it would return, crushing him beneath a parade of people no one else could see, a chorus of voices no one else could hear. The medicine helped, but the medicine was gone.
Julian had always brought the medicine, from the time he was a small boy. Arthur wasn't sure how old he was now, old enough. Sometimes Arthur wondered if he loved the boy.